ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Wednesday, the 1st of April. I'm Melissa Clark in Canberra, coming to you from Ngunnawal country and acknowledging other custodians. In the latest sign of Donald Trump's frustration with allies, he's lashed out over a lack of support for the US war effort against Iran and suggested the US will leave others to secure the Strait of Hormuz. In a social media post, the US president has told countries who can't get jet fuel that the US has done the hard part and now they need to go and get their own oil. It comes as fuel prices continue to surge, as America's editor John Lyon reports from Washington.
We start with the financial toll of the war in Iran. Right now, the average cost of gas in the United States is more than $4 a gallon.
Petrol prices at Bowser's in the US are skyrocketing as Brent crude hovers near record highs. But the US president has a word of advice for allies worried about obtaining fuel, saying on social media that nations should build up some delayed courage, go to the Strait of Hormuz and just take it. Writing, you'll have to start learning how to fight for yourself. The USA won't be there to help you anymore, just like you weren't there for us. A sentiment echoed by his defense secretary, Peter Hegseth.
So he's pointing out this is an international waterway that we use less than most, in fact, dramatically less than most. So the world ought to pay attention and be prepared to stand up. President Trump's been willing to do the heavy lifting on behalf of the free world to address this threat of Iran. It's not just our problem set going forward.
One of the president's chief targets, at the moment at least, is the United Kingdom and France, who Mr. Trump claimed would not let US planes full of military supplies bound for Israel to use its airspace. French President Emmanuel Macron's office said it was surprised to be singled out. In Qatar, Foreign Ministry spokesman Majid Al-Ansari called for a solution on reopening the Strait of Hormuz and an end to all attacks on civilian infrastructure.
The threat to Hormuz and the closure of the port in this way and the threat to the energy industry in the Arab Gulf region is actually a threat to global energy security in general.
Iran's Revolutionary Guards say they'll begin retaliating by targeting US companies in the Middle East as of tomorrow. They listed 18 companies, including major tech companies Google and Apple, as well as Tesla and Boeing. Mr. Hegseth says the next few days of this war will be decisive and claims diplomatic talks are continuing in earnest.
They're active and I think gaining strength. And we appreciate that. We would much prefer to get a deal. If Iran was willing to relinquish material they have and ambitions they have, open this, great, that's the goal. We don't want to have to do more militarily than we have to. But I didn't mean it flippantly when I said, in the meantime, we'll negotiate with bombs.
Iranian officials have been reported by Al Jazeera as saying that they have received direct messages from the US, but say this does not constitute negotiations. This is John Lyons in Washington, reporting for AM.
And as the US and Israeli war with Iran stretches into a fifth week, how it will end and when is no clearer. The Australian government continues to call for de-escalation. Ted O'Brien is the Shadow Foreign Affairs Minister and he joins us now. Ted O'Brien, thanks very much for joining me on AM this morning.
Great to be with you, Mel.
Now, we heard there Donald Trump saying that allies should go and get their own oil, and he's indicating that the US could wrap up its operations before the Strait of Hormuz is opened. Is that an acceptable outcome in your view?
Well, I've deliberately avoided making a running commentary on the comments from the president. I'd be a very busy boy if I did otherwise. I think, though, if you look through the language and the tone of the president to the key issue here, we have the Strait of Hormuz still effectively blocked. It is in the globe's interest, indeed it is in Australia's national interest for it to be opened. Clearly the message that the United States is sending is they will require assistance. They will be looking to other nations to assist with the heavy lifting to ensure that we have safe passage of vessels through that strait. This then comes to the Albanese government and questions they need to answer. What engagement have they had with our partners and allies on that question? It was disappointing that before there had been any invitation or request for assistance, you had senior ministers ruling out Australia participating at all in such efforts.
So we heard yesterday from Foreign Minister Penny Wong, and I asked her if she'd be willing to contribute to efforts to open the Strait of Hormuz, and she said Australia would be limited to defensive roles only as it has been now. Would you, if you were in government, be willing to contribute to an offensive effort to open the Strait of Hormuz, to put boots on the ground?
Well, you could have an argument as to whether it's offensive or defensive. I think the key question is it in our national interest? And my view is yes, it is. The second question is, what can we contribute in a material sense? That part of the equation we are yet to understand. And I think they're the two questions that need to be answered. One, national interest. Two, do we have the capability and equipment to make a contribution?
But we should be open to making that contribution.
I believe we should be open to making a contribution to ensure
that... Of assets or personnel or both?
Well, again, let's wait to see what is being asked of us and how we can make a contribution.
But you'd be open to personnel, potentially?
We are not talking about boots on the ground in Iran... participating directly in the war. We are talking about the need for us to have the Strait of Hormuz opened. The context in which that will be undertaken, any such activity, we are yet to know. So we're dealing with hypothetical on hypothetical on hypothetical here, which is why at this point we can only stay at a principle level. And the principles, I believe, are number one, is it in our national interest? And number two, what have we to contribute? Whether that be assets, whether that be personnel, et cetera. I mean, it's not unlike previous conversations, which is why when we sent over the Wedgetail and personnel to assist with that, the coalition backed in the government and gave them bipartisan support. I think it's now the onus is on the government to explain what conversations they are having with our partners and allies about any joint effort through the Strait of Hormuz.
Do you think Donald Trump's approach in attacking Iran has been a miscalculation?
We backed the United States and Israel in striking Iran, and I believe we should still back them. We have to keep remembering the purpose of why they went in and why you had both the Albanese government and the coalition supporting them.
But do you think there was a miscalculation in not understanding how it might play out given the circumstances we've ended up in?
I don't want to be an armchair critic sitting here in the safety of an ABC studio in Canberra. Running commentary on the activities of a live war in the Middle East. Our partners and our allies have been doing the heavy lifting for the free world. Let us not forget, we are talking about a rogue regime trying to procure a nuclear weapon, advanced missile capabilities, funding proxies that wreak terrorism around the world, including here on our shores in Australia. These are the objectives that we have supported the United States and Israel going after.
When it comes to fuel supplies, we've seen the government take various action when it comes to Australia, but we also know the government is speaking to Pacific allies to help assist them with fuel security. Does Australia have an obligation to help Pacific countries make sure they don't run out of fuel?
Australia should be doing everything it can to assist our Pacific family. There's no doubt about that. We have to remember that the rule of energy security is national security. That applies equally to other countries. And where we have our greatest obligation is within our own region. And within our region, it is our own neighbourhood, and that extends to our Pacific family.
And just briefly, are you concerned about the extent to which Israel is invading into southern Lebanon? Can it really be justified when Hezbollah's abilities have been severely degraded already?
Well, when you have the northern end of Israel seeing drones, missiles rain down, you can understand their communities and the fear that they feel, which is why, again, this is connected to what's happening in Iran, because you have one of Iran's proxies, Hezbollah, undertaking those activities attacking Israel. Now, Israel has moved into the southern parts of Lebanon. They have done so as an act of self-defence. They have said that they have no intention to capture territory, to expand the territoriality of their sovereignty. Rather, they are creating a security buffer to ensure that their own people are kept safe.
They have talked about keeping areas of southern Lebanon clear of inhabitants. I mean, that's beyond just removing a threat. That's removing people from being able to live in some of those spaces.
From what Israel is advising, this is a temporary move. This is not maintaining control and extending their own territoriality.
Ted O'Brien, thank you very much for speaking to me this morning. The federal government has moved to shore up supplies of fertiliser as farmers across the country warn of food shortages and price spikes. It's committed to underwriting fertiliser purchases by the private sector and will hold off on introducing a new export charge on producers for a year. Food security experts say it's a step in the right direction, but the government needs to make the country's agriculture less reliant on international supply chains, as Oliver Gordon reports.
West Australian banana farmer Doriana Mangili's crop has been battered by two cyclones in 2 months.
Bananas don't like strong winds, so anything over 100 kilometres an hour, they start to fall over. That's resulted in the loss of about 80% of our plants.
The mammoth task of replanting the Carnarvon crop has become even harder, with the surging price and limited availability of fertilisers.
So the cost of our fertilisers pretty much doubled in price in the last few weeks. We're fortunate that we're still able to purchase a fertiliser, but that'll be the next challenge, not only doubling in price, but availability.
Looking to reassure struggling farmers, the federal government will underwrite the purchase of fertiliser by the private sector, meaning it'll take on the financial risk of those companies importing and buying fertiliser. It will also hold off introducing a new export charge on producers for a year, a move Doriana Mangili approves of.
We can live without everything else pretty much, but we can't live without food.
The federal government's also created a fertiliser task force. National Farmers Federation CEO Michael Guerin wants it to expedite financial assistance to farmers in need.
We would argue we are facing a disaster right now if we don't declare it and support it. So that's one practical piece that we will be looking to get through the task force in the short term.
He says much like petrol and diesel, ships carrying fertiliser are being held up.
We know there are a number of shipments, particularly of urea, stuck short of the strait, the Hormuz Strait, and can't get through.
Fertiliser is crucial to Australia's food bowl. So what does a shortage mean for our food supply? RMIT University food systems expert Kelly Donati says it'll be tighter.
That might mean that there are particular items that we are not able to buy in the supermarket, or that there might be some rationing of them, as we've seen in the past. But I think what we are going to see is a significant rise in the cost of food, and that means that some people will not be able to afford food.
The academic says the current crisis has shown how reliant Australian food systems are on international supply chains.
We really need to be focusing on localising our markets as much as possible, investing in infrastructure that allows for that localisation, so that's supply chain and processing infrastructure, to make sure that food that's grown in the regions can be accessed by the regions and that Australians can access the food that this country is actually producing. That, I think, is the lesson to be learned.
RMIT University food systems expert Kelly Donati ending Oliver Gordon's report. More than 80,000 Australian children aged 5 and under are not fully up to date with their vaccinations. Experts are warning the decline in vaccination rates will result in more severe illness and death in Australia from preventable diseases. Here's National Health Equity reporter Caitlin Gribben.
This is Blake's first photo of his eye-opening in ICU.
Perth mother Naomi Steenson is reflecting on her son's short life.
They brought him out of his induced coma and I was able to get my first cuddle.
As a newborn in 1997, Blake contracted whooping cough and after weeks in intensive care, he died.
Could see the writing on the wall that he was not coming back, our normal Blake. We asked them to turn his machine off.
Blake was too young to be immunised and a vaccine was not yet available for pregnant women. Naomi says no parent should have to endure the heartache of losing a baby.
A little bit of discomfort for a child certainly beats living 6 weeks in intensive care, having to turn your child's life support off. If we're all immunised, hopefully it stops others from getting it.
It's the same message vaccine experts are urgently sharing, as new data shows tens of thousands of children aged 5 and under aren't fully immunised.
In 2025, there were 80,000 children in Australia not up to date with their vaccines.
National Centre for Immunisation Research and Surveillance Director Christine McCartney.
Every age group, we're continuing to see vaccine coverage is falling, and it's been falling year on year now since 2020. We're really going in the wrong direction.
Alarmingly, the proportion of one-year-olds up to date with vaccinations is at its lowest in 12 years. Christine McCartney says vulnerable people, including babies, are facing greater risks.
We'll absolutely see more deaths from vaccine-preventable diseases if we continue to see the decline we are seeing now.
Professor McCartney is also concerned about immunisation rates in First Nations children, where coverage has dropped below 90% at 1 and 2 years of age. She says there's no one single reason for vaccine declines, as there are issues with access to and acceptance of immunisations. On the acceptance side, Professor McCartney says vaccine fatigue set in during the COVID-19 pandemic.
Some people really felt genuinely against vaccines at a period of time when that was equated with lockdowns. But I'd ask people to separate that, focus on the really strong, scientific, valid information about vaccines.
Perth mother Naomi Steenson backs that approach. She should be celebrating her son Blake's 29th birthday with him this year. Instead, she's honouring Blake through her advocacy.
If you don't do this immunisation, we are going to lose children. We're going to lose babies.
Perth mother Naomi Steenson ending Caitlin Gribben's report. In a statement, the Federal Health Minister Mark Butler said the government is continuing the childhood immunisation education campaign for parents and carers in an effort to increase vaccination rates and address misinformation. Now, if you feel like you're stuck paying for a subscription that you never really wanted, well, this next story might be good news for you. The federal government will today introduce legislation to crack down on subscription traps, hidden fees, and other tricky sales tactics. Isabel Masali reports.
Gold Coast man Jonathan Edwards has signed up for a number of different programs or apps that overstayed their welcome.
Quite often it's been something I've bought on the spur of a moment and I thought I'll use that for a month or two and then get rid of it. But of course, as life's pretty busy, you tend to forget what you've signed up for. And then before you know it, there's all these charges appearing on your bank statement.
He estimates he's lost about $1,000 over a few years. A big hurdle is just making contact to cancel subscriptions.
Generally, it's fairly convoluted and difficult to get through. And that's becoming, I think, more and more difficult as we go on because a lot of the companies are now starting to use AI agents. And some of these agents are so convincing that you actually do think you're speaking to a human.
Erin Turner from the Consumer Policy Research Centre hopes a decade-long battle to end this practice is nearly over, with the federal government set to introduce new laws to Parliament today.
They broadly ban unfair business practices, where businesses use their power or knowledge to trick or trap you, take advantage of you. They specifically ban subscription traps. That's where companies make it very easy for you to pay them money, but very hard to stop. It also takes specific action against drip pricing, where companies don't make it clear that there's fees or extra add-ons when you go to book. All this adds up to making it really clear that businesses can't be jerks. They have to treat you fairly.
While business groups are concerned it'll increase the cost and complexity of their work, Treasurer Jim Chalmers says these changes are about cracking down on dodgy deals to save consumers money. Erin Turner explains it'll apply to any business that sells to Australians.
The penalties in our consumer law are world-leading, and they do act as meaningful deterrents. These are fines that should make businesses sit up and take notice.
Stephanie Tonkin from the Consumer Action Law Centre in Victoria hopes this legal crackdown on manipulating consumers will even stop multi-level marketing.
Which is a model very similar to pyramid schemes, is at the moment legal. There's nothing preventing it. But if you look at the type of conduct and the type of practice that it involves people signing onto a scheme where they will never make money. And the people signing these people up, in most cases, those at the very top of the scheme, know that the people at the bottom of the scheme are never going to make money. clear example of manipulation.
If passed, these changes will apply from July next year.
Isabel Massali. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Melissa Clark.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. With the Easter holiday period almost upon us, many motorists will be questioning whether they're going to be able to fill up their cars to get around. Today, Sol Kovanec, energy expert at MST Financial, on what to expect and why the government's fuel incentives might make things worse. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.